Senate Environment Committee will come to order. We've got a lengthy agenda, so we want to make sure that we get to work. We want to continue the discussion of invasive species today, because there were a lot of questions from members and there wasn't enough time because of the State of the State address. And so we've asked the DNR to come back and continue our follow-up with discussion from members, just to see what questions there are and if, to answer any, just as a follow-up from last committee. Before we get into that, I wanted to talk a little bit about Wednesday's hearing on dedicated funding. What we're going to do is there are five bills that we're going to have on the agenda. No action is going to be taken on any of the bills on Wednesday, but this is an opportunity for the authors to present their present their legislation. And so what we'll do is we'll take the bills at the beginning of the hearing and have each author explain their bill and say whatever they want about it. And then what we'll do is, as far as public witnesses are concerned, we will take those stakeholders after the presentation of the individual bills by the authors. So because there's so much overlap on the issues in each bill, we thought instead of dividing stakeholders into one bill or another, we'll just have all of those folks who want to testify on, who are interested in dedicated funding, to testify on their particular interest after the presentation of the individual bills. And so that'll constitute the public portion of that testimony. If you want to testify on dedicated funding, definitely contact my committee administrator, Mary Ann, so that she can get you on the list. Okay, any questions on that? DNR Archaeological Services, Mr. Hirsch. Where we left off, I think last hearing was Senator Dibble had some questions that he wanted to follow up on. So go ahead, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Chair. And I did put a voicemail into both DNR and Ag, so they know what I'm curious about. I wanted to do a little bit of follow up on the firewood program that was just touched on briefly in the presentation, because it sounded like there was something larger in the works than the brief mention of it revealed. So I was just curious, just kind of exactly, you know, what the program proposes to do, if in fact the whole program of figuring out, you know, what kind of firewood is safe to use and what isn't, and if we're going to certify firewood, you know, as safe, and figure out how to educate the larger public on importing firewood, and you know, kind of where we are in our thinking and development. What to do about firewood. It's kind of a big deal. It's going to be, as Senator Vickerman pointed out, it's going to be a huge change in the way people think about something so simple as firewood, and so it's going to be a substantial change in behavior, but also probably a lot of work on the part of some authorities to figure all this out. So I was wondering where we are and how much it's going to cost, all of that.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Tomlinson. I'm the assistant director with the DNR Division of Forestry. Forestry will be working with the Division of Parks and others in the department to address the firewood issue and the fact that it's the major source of transporting pests such as the emerald ash borer and other insect pests and otherwise like that around the state. And essentially what we're trying to do is a culture change within the state of Minnesota, try and get folks more in tune with the perhaps it's a better alternative to purchase firewood at the place where they want to camp long term, and try and move in that direction. You know, in that regards, we are going to propose legislation, which I believe will be introduced later this week, if I'm not mistaken, that, and I'm not sure who the author is, I apologize, on the Senate side over here, or nor for that matter on the House side, but we're lining those folks up. Legislation will be introduced that would basically ban firewood from being brought in, other than approved firewood, into state forest parks and state forest campgrounds. And we've had meetings with stakeholder groups out there, like other private sector camping facilities and otherwise, that are, I believe, going to be pretty supportive of this effort, because they have as much in stake at this as the rest of us do. And what's at stake is basically the fact that Minnesota has apparently the third largest population of ash in the nation. It's very significant. It's not that significant a component when it comes right down to it in the wood-using industries. And as I, apparently Senator Vickerman was asking some questions last week relative to the transporting of logs and things like that, it actually only represents about 1% of the use of fiber going into the wood-using industry. So it's not really moved around an awful lot, the ash isn't. But the primary movement is in firewood. And we're very concerned about that because of the problems associated with emerald ash borer and otherwise. And the other thing I would remind folks is that when we had Dutch elm disease, a lot of the trees that were replaced were done with ash. And unfortunately, that's occurred. And so it's imperative that we kind of get on top of this and do something about it. And if nothing else, buy us some more time. That's kind of where we're going with it. Within the department, we'll have legislation out later this week.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So follow up with a couple of questions. One is, tell me more about, you know, how firewood is approved, or how a dealer, firewood dealer is approved to sell firewood for use in the state parks, and does that also lend itself to a process of certifying firewood as safe for fires that aren't going to be occurring inside the state park? You know, people use firewood, buy firewood all the time for their own personal use on their own property or places outside of state parks for both fires and fireplaces and campfires of that sort. I mean, are we looking at a, you know, because clearly this is only going to get a hold of a small part of the problem, just getting handled on the state park.
Senator Dibble, members, we haven't thoroughly discussed it. We've been thoroughly discussing it. What we haven't arrived to yet is the agreement within the department of how we will approve firewood, what an approved vendor is going to be and everything. I can tell you that the direction we're going and it's likely to be is that it will be something where we will approve vendors that are within a certain mile radius of the facility where the camping will occur, be it Itasca Park or other state forest campground or something like that. And what we're trying to do is advocate with different folks who are already in the business of cutting firewood, and you see them around out in outstate Minnesota oftentimes, going out working with those folks to just make sure that they've got wood available for campers and that we have an alternative source for campers to go to get that firewood within a certain reasonable distance from the state park. I can't say at this point what that distance is going to be because we haven't come to that agreement within the department yet. There's meetings being held tomorrow on this matter, as a matter of fact, and it'll be better known by then. So that's kind of what the direction that we're trying to go as far as approving it. I should mention that the program that we're basically looking at will be a real strong communication and education program, which we don't really need to wait for legislation on. We're already beginning that effort. You saw the article in the paper, I think, a week or so ago talking about the hazards of moving firewood around and things. So we'll be continuing with that. So a real strong communication education program, another effort relative to providing, approving, and assuring that there's firewood available through alternative sources for campers when they arrive at state parks or state forest campgrounds. That's a second component to it. And then the third one, I would say, would be in the event that we haven't been totally successful with the education campaign, would be some sort of an effort to confiscate any firewood that shows up that doesn't come from an approved vendor or an approved source, and disposing of that in a proper way so that we don't have any problems with emerald ash borer or otherwise coming out of those things. So those are kind of the three main components, if you will, that we're talking about at this point. And that'll be detailed out for you in fact sheets and otherwise when we come before the committee in the near future on this item.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Well, and sounds like we're going to have the opportunity for a much more thorough discussion as the bill comes forward, so I'll save some of my additional inquiries for that. But just real quickly, is the Department of Agriculture involved in this? I mean, it sounds like we're really confining our thoughts to state parks and campfires in state parks, and not talking about the larger issue.
We work pretty closely with the Department of Agriculture. I would mention that, by and large, we're looking at agriculture's role relative to the commercial ways that wood is moved around, and that this niche is more for non-commercial activities. I'll let Geer kind of speak more to that, maybe.
Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, my name's Geer Friso. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, Director of the Plant Protection Division. The department has been working very closely with the DNR for several months on the firewood issue. We were very supportive of their efforts to provide some restrictions on movement onto DNR land. The department has been very active in investigating pathways that we regulate, whether it be nursery stock or the logging industry or some of those commercial pathways. So the one pathway that we have a hard time addressing has been the aspect of firewood, and so we think this goes very well with our efforts to prevent the introduction of emerald ash borer or any other invasive species, whether it be gypsy moth or something else. So there's very, again, very close cooperation between the two agencies.
Let me get to Senator Frederickson first. Did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, I did. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Thomason, the discussion we've had here has revolved around state parks. Has there been any discussion, including rural or metro regional parks or larger city parks in this program?
Mr. Friso.
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, no, we haven't directly suggested to them that they want to follow suit, but clearly what we're trying to do here is lead by example with the state park system, the state forest campground system, and that others would see the wisdom of this as well and follow suit with it.
Mr. Chair, Senator
Frederickson.
Senator, the Department of Agriculture and the Firewood Committee has made some contacts with private campgrounds and other parks in an effort of trying to gauge their level of cooperation. I'm pleased to report that I think they'd be very interested in joining some efforts contain introduction of firewood. There are, again, federal quarantines already in place to prevent the movement of firewood, at least theoretically, from areas that are infested with gypsy moth or emerald ash borer, but unfortunately, oftentimes people aren't aware of those quarantines.
Okay, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We maybe can defer this conversation to when we take up Senator Stevens' bill on the Great Lakes invasive problem. It was mentioned briefly in the presentation the other day, but and like I said, we can wait departments, but I'm curious about, you know, how active the state has been in trying to deal with the introduction of invasive aquatic species in the Great Lakes. So I know it's a federal problem, and you know, we've been trying to wait for federal action, but it's been forthcoming in any meaningful way that I've been able to distill a concern for many years now, and it seems like every two or three months now we're. Muscle or mussel or some sort of snail, you know, and there's an article in the paper from last year talked about every 7 months a new species establishing a foothold in the Great Lakes, and those get into the inland waterways quite easily. So I'm just curious, what is the, specifically the state's role in trying to stop this from happening?
Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Jay Rendell. I'm the DNR Invasive Species Program Coordinator. The issue of ballast water as a pathway of introduction has been on our radar screen for many years. We actually had a LCMR project, I think in at least 10 years ago, that tried to look at ballast water demonstration technologies to see if we could help move along the industry, and that was a $250,000 project. We've been quite an advocate for better federal regulations for many years. I've gone and testified at Congress on the national bills, and we've tried to encourage through different working groups the formulation of good bills to deal with ballast water. And it's quite a complex issue. We met with Senator Rest a year ago, and some of the issues are related to the international commerce, interstate commerce, areas that are marginal or not the state's responsibility. And so there's a number of those issues. And actually, our state law prohibits the introduction of those organisms into our state waters. But when you have vessels that are actually a foreign country that come to our state, it's difficult for us to enforce laws against those vessels, and the Coast Guard is probably the only one who has authority to board those vessels. So there's a number of complex issues about this. The technology is improving. The International Maritime Organization is working on international ballast water guidelines, and so there is progress being made, but it's, as Senator Dibble mentioned, we have new introductions every year into the Great Lakes, and it's a continuing problem.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand some of the complexity. I had one of those bills once. It's just, for members to contemplate, it is outrageous to think that we have to tolerate these sorts of things coming into our waters and have nothing to say about it. I can't imagine, other places seeing with these critters coming in, being dumped, liberally into Superior Harbor and taking hold. It's a huge threat, not just to the ecology of Lake Superior, but as we know, a number of those have now made their way into the inland waters, and I just think it's time we've got to put our foot down as a state, legal or otherwise. We're flirting with a tremendous disaster already. We've got huge problems with established themselves, shoving out other animals and creating all kinds of havoc. It's just, if we sit around and wait for the Coast Guard to take action, it's just not going to happen. Year in, year out, year after year, sitting around these tables, just nothing has happened on this. And it's outrageous, and I don't even know if we even have any time left, given the number of places that have established themselves in our waters. But certainly waiting is no longer an option. Shame that our state leadership hasn't seen fit to just put their foot down and make it happen either. So I think we have to act as a body. Let them sue us. So I say, but we've got some really, really bad animals coming into our water and shoving out our native species and really disrupting the ecology of our water.
Further discussion from the members? If not, I want to thank the DNR for their accommodating coming back to answer these questions. We'll be talking about this issue more. Next item on the agenda is continuation of A History of the Land, Episode 4, Second Nature. There's some discussion in this episode about Lake Superior, and so that's why we scheduled the Great Lakes Compact and Senator Stevens' resolution on the same day.
I'm supposed to talk to you about something. new one. Investigation of this lake would revolutionize the emerging field of ecology, which at the time was still more art than science. Ecology started out natural history. As such, a lot of ecology dealt with the biology of particular species that somebody found interesting, not very much dealt with whole systems, with ecosystems. In the 1930s, researchers like Aldo Leopold and Sigurd Olsen were moving toward an understanding of ecosystems. Raymond Lindemann was determined to move beyond description and begin to tease apart the mystery of how ecosystems actually work. He had ideas that were really radical for his day. He took quantitative samples. He wanted to know where the nitrogen came from, where it went to, what happened to the other nutrients, what happened to the carbon. And no one had ever taken this kind of approach before. For more than 5 years, the couple collected countless samples of water, plants, microscopic organisms, worms, crustaceans, and fish. Based on how they acquired, used, and passed on energy. Based on the data, he created a picture of the lake rendered entirely in terms of how nutrients and energy moved through its various parts. It was a work of astounding originality.
Well, the reason that the work of Ray Lindemann is so important and carries on as a intellectual legacy till today is because for the first time he and other scientists like him around the world were thinking of ecosystems as very interconnected at every scale. It's changed the way we look at the world.
By examining in its entirety the food web of one small place, Lindemann unlocked the door to the inner workings of ecosystems. Raymond Lindemann never lived to see the impact of his work. He died at the age of 27, just months before the journal Ecology published his research on Cedar Bog Lake. And though his findings essentially jump-started the field of modern ecology, his contribution was barely felt in the world at large. It was 1942, war. New technologies developed in the war effort, coupled with the sharp rise in consumer demand in the post-war years, would unleash a period of unparalleled changes in the land. Lake Superior, one of North America's crown jewels, would be threatened. And with a boom in population, cities would spread out across the Minnesota landscape. As Minnesota reached mid-century, it had acquired the technology to totally reorder nature. But it would be decades before Ray Lindemann's revolutionary ideas would enable us to understand the consequences.
Thank you. for lake herring.
Tourists come in and they ask how long I've been taking them. They say about a little over 60 years. Well, that's really nice. They say it's in the blood.
Eckel is a living connection to an era when commercial fishing on Lake Superior was a thriving business.
Kind of like going to the casino.
We have a large fishery on this lake. It supported just Lake Superior alone about 400 commercial fishermen. If you traveled the shore of Lake Superior, there were, you know, smoked fish houses all along the shore.
Isolated villages along the lake, many continued the subsistence fishing they had practiced in Europe. What began as a cottage industry grew quickly into a bustling enterprise. The number of commercial fishermen on Lake Superior exploded, and the fish they all wanted most was whitefish. By 1885, fishermen were catching more than 5 million pounds a year.
People love to eat them, they're tasty fish. Most fish stay shallow their entire life cycle. So, in other words, they're susceptible to being over-harvested. Their stocks immediately started to decline. The reason that these fish were over-harvested has nothing to do with the fact that these were bad people who were out to get what they could and get out of there. They were just basically fishing the way they grew up. You went out, you harvested until it wasn't there anymore, and then you moved on to another spot. You really didn't know whether fish came back or not.
In the opening years of the 20th century, the yearly catch of whitefish was plummeting, and fishermen began turning to another species, Superior's lake trout. What appeared to fishermen to be a limitless resource was in reality a finite population, one that had taken the lake thousands of years to produce. Plunge to depths of more than 1,000 feet. different species coexisted in a delicately balanced system. At the bottom of the food chain were microscopic plants and animals. These supported a host of smaller fish like herring, whitefish, and minnows. And at the top of the food chain were the fish-eating fish like walleye, burbot, and ciscoette. But the king was the lake trout, growing to more than 5 feet in length and weighing more than 60 pounds. They could live up to 50 years. As Lake Superior's top predator, the lake trout played a central role in maintaining the health of the entire food chain. World War II created an enormous demand for food and led to new technologies to catch fish. Outboard motors would increase the range of fishermen, and the replacement of cotton twine nets with nylon would double the rate of the haul. Superior is the largest and the cleanest of the Great Lakes. But beginning in the 1950s, the purity of the lake would be threatened. Among the first to notice were North Shore fishermen.
My uncles complained about the dust or dirt in their nets at Castle Danger about 1958-59. Realized that something was happening to the lake after the taconite tailings began being dumped in the lake.
marked an early and important battle in the environmental movement of the 1960s and 70s.
It looks clear and safe enough to drink, and that's the question that will be decided in court. Martin Jacobs, Channel 5 News, Silver Bay, Minnesota.
In a divisive struggle that lasted more than a decade, Iron Range workers confronted local activists, and industry faced off against state and federal governments in a landmark federal court case.
It was so tough that I didn't dare go into Silver Bay. I had to stay away from the fence.
Minnesota's Iron Range provided most of the ore for the steel that helped the Allies win World War II. The end of the war brought a return to prosperity and unleashed an enormous demand for consumer goods and for the steel to make them. But the high-grade iron ore that the mines had relied upon was running out.
A hard rock had been found in good abundance. The rock itself was called taconite. Perhaps here was a solution to the depletion of Minnesota iron ore.
The Reserve Mining Company led the world into a new era in 1955 when it cut the ribbon on a new taconite processing plant in Silver Bay, Minnesota. The taconite pellets produced here were a boon to steel manufacturers. Uniform in size and iron content, they could be burned efficiently in the blast furnaces of Gary, Chicago, and Cleveland.
Reserve Mining was the first of a whole series of taconite processing plants that was built. And it was situated on the shore of Lake Superior at what is now Silver Bay. And it was convenient because of the access to water and both for processing and for disposal of waste.
This is a 3-pound sample of taconite which has been crushed. From this, the mining companies produce 1 pound of concentrate, which is then pelletized, which is the saleable material. This large pile is the quartz, which is discarded. 1 pound of saleable material, 2 pounds of waste.
I went down to the gate one day with my deputy and said, I want to go down and see this tailings discharge. So I did. They would dump the slag or the waste right into Lake Superior through these huge launder chutes, they call them. You stand there next to that big chute, or two chutes, you hear this tremendous roar. It's like a big waterfall.
By the late 1960s, Reserve Mining was dumping up to 67,000 tons of waste a day.
And they gradually built a delta out so that when they were dumping down on the delta, and then they had to extend the launder chutes. Pretty soon they built a delta of about 300 acres.
Most of the tailings settled to the bottom of the lake. But some of the waste, tiny particles known as fines, floated on the surface, creating an enormous area of cloudy water. In 1970, nearly 15 years after the plant opened, some North Shore residents began to call for an end to the dumping. Arnold Overby, a third-generation North Shore resident, was a teacher at Silver Bay High School.
The old timer said, well, you can't do anything. It's not going to work. You can't go against a big company like that. Well, I was new to this. I never got involved in anything. But this is one point in life where I thought, you know, I got to take a stand on this one. Other people, being to the North Shore, felt the same way, and we formed the St. Lake Superior Association.
They were soon joined by a student organization known as the Students for Environmental Defense from the nearby Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota.
It was a natural for a student group that was centered here in the town of Lake Superior to take this on.
Some 30 years on from their student days, the former activists remain friends.
I think a lot of the push, or a lot of the impetus for the Students for Environmental Defense really was part of growing national awareness. We weren't isolated, we weren't unique, we didn't start something that hadn't been started elsewhere. Environmental awareness was something that was building at the time.
Soon, national organizations like the Sierra Club joined in the campaign to stop the pollution of Lake Superior. In response to growing concerns about the dumping, federal government convened a series of public meetings around the reserve mining issue.
At the first conference at that Hotel Duluth, it's a very street in Duluth, we had 600 people in the audience. That covered it.
I remember going to the Hotel Duluth and listening to, you know, just being a part of that crowd of people. You know, so many people knew the facts and things like that, but going down there and just being a body saying, no, you can't keep doing this. You cannot do this.
They'll not be satisfied until every company, every municipality is stopped from polluting Lake Superior.
If it hadn't been for public opinion, this case never would have gotten to a lawsuit.
Their mining company has no real interest in cleaning up the pollution of Lake Superior, which is going on in ever-increasing quantity. We believe that this has now become a test case.
Expert testimony from the enforcement conferences showed that the waste from reserve had drifted beyond Minnesota waters. This made it a federal case. In January of 1972, the Environmental Protection Agency filed suit against reserve mining. Several months later, reserve's corporate parents, ARMCO and Republic Steel, were ordered to join the case.
This lawsuit is one of the first concerted efforts by state and federal agencies to attack a major polluter. If the environmentalists are successful in their legal fight, the case would be a milestone in future battles against pollution.
In advance of the trial, reserve mining lobbied hard in the court of public opinion. With thousands of employees in the state, reserve mining wielded considerable political clout.
Naturally, I am concerned with this because we have two cities on the North Shore of Lake Superior dependent on this facility. There are some 4,000 steel workers' jobs, and I'm willing to fight for them.
Naturally, the company was using the employees as hostages, so you had jobs versus the environment.
Reserve insisted that shifting to disposal on land would bankrupt the company, resulting in the closing of the plant and the destruction of the town of Silver Bay.
The company, of course, wouldn't admit to any problems. They were getting by much cheaper than the other titanite companies. They had to put their tailings on land in tailings basins, and the reserve got by for years by just dumping it in public water, Lake Superior.
Just 2 months before the trial began, the Environmental Protection Agency issued an alarming public health alert. Drinking water in several North Shore communities contained fibers that looked like asbestos. The possibility that human health was threatened by the continued dumping upped the ante on an already polarized debate.
This is a sample of Lake Superior water taken here in front of a reserve mining plant. It looks clear and safe enough to drink. And that's the question that will be decided in court.
It's very, very difficult when you have a health problem versus unemployment. But I would have to side with public health, and I think that must come first.
The trial began in August of 1973 in the federal court of Judge Miles Lord in downtown St. Paul. After 9 months of testimony, the trial reached its climax when Judge Lord rendered his final decision.
Federal Judge Miles Lord has ordered all discharge from Reserve Silver Bay Plant halted as of 1 minute past midnight tonight. Minnesota PCA Director Grant Merritt hailed the judge's decision as a courageous move, setting a significant legal precedent.
A court is faced with the evidence of a public health hazard of this magnitude and the environmental pollution of this magnitude that strong action can be taken.
My comments, insofar as this case is concerned, are included in my opinion. Thank you.
But it was too early for victory speeches. Just 24 hours after Lord shut down the plant, a circuit court of appeals in St. Louis reversed his decision.
Continue to dump its tailings to the Lake Superior until at least May 15th. That's when the appeals court in St. Louis will meet to decide whether or not to let Reserve continue its operations. Martin Jacobs, Channel 5 Eyewitness News, Silver Bay.
Reserve was allowed to resume operations in Silver Bay while the case worked its way through the appeals process. In fact, it wasn't until 1980, 6 years after Judge Lord's initial decision, the Reserve was finally forced to stop dumping its waste into Lake Superior. The dumping of taconite tailings on land continues to this day at a site just a few miles from Lake Superior. This area, known as Milepost 7, is not accessible by public road, so few have seen it. Stopping the flow of tailings directly into Lake Superior was a victory for grassroots citizens groups, like the Students for Environmental Defense and the Save Lake Superior Association.
It showed a lot of people in the U.S. that citizens could, through developing public opinion, take on a big, giant company and resolve a problem and keep the jobs.
We're very idealistic, and I think many of us are still idealistic today. We think that you can accomplish things as individuals, you can accomplish things as society, and that environmental concerns are very important.
I mean, I think we should though submit a letter, even though it's after the time period.
If we have something solid to submit,
yeah.
Who knows what the level of this information is on the state? It might only be 100 million times the number. It might be 300. Nobody knows.
So I think I'm honored by ancestry by doing what I've done. I feel that it's sort of a major accomplishments in my life. Being part of the system that is able to get the taconite tailings out of Lake Superior.
Thank you.
reserve mining case was being resolved, fishery biologists were beginning to make headway restoring lake trout populations.
When we started doing this, we were probably looking at 90% of the stock fish, and now we're looking at well over half our wild fish, and maybe even more than that.
The rehabilitation of lake trout in Lake Superior has been probably one of the real major successes in fisheries management, probably worldwide. What was disappointing to people is they thought that within 5 or 10 years they would see results. And it really took 50 years to get where we are today.
Lamprey were treated and controlled. Major restrictions were imposed on both commercial and sport trout fishing. And lake trout hatched and reintroduced around the lake. Eventually, trout populations rebounded, and some stability was restored to the food chain. Despite the real success of restoring the fishery, the lake's delicate food chain is still vulnerable.
When the next exotic shows up is anybody's guess, and whether it will be one of those sea lamprey type of exotics or a rather benign exotic that just disappears from the system, you know, we don't know.
But you have to remember, ecology is a fairly young field. It really got started, this trophic ecology, with a graduate student at the University of Minnesota named Lindenen. He started looking at a bog and how energy is transferred up the food chain in the 1940s. So we're new at this. We're just learning.
While the lake is beginning to recover from the massive dumping by reserve mining, there are new challenges to preserving the water quality in the bold, cold lake.
We earlier thought we could solve the problem by identifying concentrated, intense impacts. We were wrong. We need to look at taking an ecosystem approach.
The kinds of things that are happening on the North Shore, as everyone's noticed, it's a pretty place to be. It's where you want to build your house, it's where you want to put in a new septic field. It's where you want to put in a golf course. All the sorts of regular human development that leads to non-point source pollution. Movement of sediment and for water, nutrients, all the things that come off of parking lots and so forth. All these things can be a problem.
The bottom line is the types of practices we do on the land, whether they be positive or negative, are reflected in what we see in the water.
Has spent his entire career studying Lake Superior. Yet the lake still manages to inspire awe and humility in this veteran researcher.
It is the largest body of fresh water in the world. Even though we've had huge amounts of changes in the lake, just the resilience of the lake is something that astounds me.
Most will choose to live in the suburbs.
I can see a lot of people moving here. I think it's an ideal place to live. You get the four seasons and definitely a good community. Start out small.
I'd like to build eventually. Find an undeveloped area, maybe out in New Market. That's getting a little bigger now, too, even. But somewhere undeveloped and build. Yeah, I like the land. All on property.
Minnesota's past is rooted in its natural resources, its forests, rivers, lakes, and prairies, then here lies one vision of its future, the modern suburb.
One of the challenges for suburban residents, I think, is to recognize the way in which the houses they live in and the offices they work in are connected to the landscape around them. Whether you live in an urban setting, whether you live in the suburbs, we're intimately connected to our environment.
I'm okay.
Right now, when a piece of land is developed, nobody measures the cost to the quality of groundwater. Nobody measures the cost to biological diversity. These are never measured. All we measure is the gain and the value of that piece of land. So economics right now measures half the equation.
The road to the future was paved in the middle 1950s, when a new way of life emerged.
This explosion outward of the development during that period, where people were shown the opportunities of living in the suburban zone. What we call sprawl, they called good planning. Good planning meant allowing people to move to lower density, lower housing, have some employment out there. But they thought they could build a manageable metropolitan area. And I have to say that we proved them wrong.
The metropolitan area of the Twin Cities grew steadily after the turn of the 19th century. But with the end of World War II and the arrival of the interstate highway system, growth exploded. Expansion quickened through the 1960s and 70s, and is accelerating today.
It's the simple question of where will we put the next million is, I think, is up for grabs.
In the 1990s, the area southwest of the Twin Cities was one of the fastest growing regions in the nation. Much of Scott County lies along the Minnesota River Valley, an area of wetlands, lakes, and farms nestled amidst hills.
Well, we're out in the center, the possible center of the future city of Jackson.
Elmer Marshall owns a farm that used to be on the outskirts of Shakopee. Because of rapid growth, the Marshall farm is now an island surrounded by a sea of housing developments.
Something to remember about the urbanization of Minnesota is a lot of our communities were centered around good agricultural land, some of the best farmland that you're going to find anywhere.
They see the organic matter in that soil, some of the most productive soil in the world. Also, it's dry in that soil surface, crumbles nicely. People in the southeastern and southern part of the country would just about kill for that kind of soil.
Topsoil has been scraped away, and that's what they do to the topsoil in development. They scrape it away and it's hauled off somewhere. You and I don't know how to reproduce that topsoil, and I would dare say that all of the great
our machinery. My great-grandfather settled here in 1862, which is 141 years ago, and it's been in the Marshall family. There's six generations of Marshall living on the farm right now. And, well, I guess this will be the end of it now.
Systems, rainfall is slowly absorbed by soil, wetlands, lakes, and rivers. It can take decades for rainwater to complete this hydrologic cycle. And as the water filters through the system, it's purified. But the built environment, with its vast expanses of concrete, interrupts that process.
Is it?
And that means more runoff. That runoff is going directly to receiving basins, to rivers, lakes, streams, with very little intermediate infiltration. An inch of rain falling on 1 square mile of asphalt creates more than 17 million gallons of runoff water. In most communities, that water runs directly into the sewer system, bypasses the treatment plant, and is dumped into local lakes, streams, and rivers. In the Twin Cities, all of that water winds up in the Mississippi River.
Here in Minnesota, we are the headwaters of the Mississippi River, so everything we do impacts everybody, extending all the way downstream. So it's important for us to be good stewards and protectors of the river.
But the river is more than just its water. The Mississippi is at the heart of a vast wooded corridor that stretches from Minnesota to the Gulf of Mexico and beyond. It provides crucial habitat for a host of migratory birds.
Actually, a large percentage of the birds in Minnesota are what we would call neotropical line birds.
Scarlet tanager.
They breed here. They raise families here. But come fall, the birds all migrate, and not just to the southern states, but actually into Central America and South America.
Hummingbirds, you might not know, fly 500 miles over the Gulf of Mexico as they're heading back down to the tropics.
Birds are the connective tissue between us here in the upper Midwest and the rainforests of South America.
The Mississippi River Corridor is part of the longest flyway in the Western Hemisphere, stretching from the Arctic North to the southern tip of South America. A host of waterfowl and other birds make this annual migration.
We hear frequently of species going extinct. topics and concerns about habitat destruction topics. It's also important to recognize that we have species that breed here in Minnesota, bird species, that are threatened primarily due to our actions that will have unforeseen consequences on the communities, the ecology of tropical forests.
What's a really important flyway, the Mississippi flyway, particularly here in the Twin Cities?
Such species, the henslow sparrow, a small bird with a big voice.
Probably 2 inches tall, although I've never measured it, 13 grams in weight, very tiny. This is an endangered species in Minnesota. It's gone down at an annual rate of 8% per year since 1966. And in recent years, it has gone down even more rapidly.
Remember that when a subdivision goes in, once we've scraped off the topsoil, it's not going to come back again. Once we change the land, subdivide it, that's the way it's going to be, probably forever.
The largest flour mill in the world. stood for more than a century as a symbol of Minnesota's progress. Its closing marked the end of a chapter in history, one that resulted in remarkable changes in the land.
No one questioned the necessity of cutting those trees. They recognized a higher necessity of plowing it, of making it into rectangular farm fields and into productive land.
Once there were clouds of passenger pigeons, no one could believe that they could become extinct, and yet they became extinct. It's so important to know the way it was and the price that we pay if we don't pay attention.
We have made a lot of mistakes in the past. It would be wise for us to learn from those mistakes.
I think in part we started to realize that we were losing. People started to value and question, you know, perhaps the path upon which we had gone.
Think about what Minnesotans have done. We've been able to improve the water quality, our lakes, our streams, our rivers. We've been able to preserve beautiful and important landscapes. And we've had all these kind of environmental heroes who can give us hope in the future.
Amazing planet that we live on. And we are, whether we like it or not, stewards for that planet.
Is it only four parts?
Or is it six? Kind of sounded like the ending.
There's a fifth one, just on log, just on timber.
Oh, okay.
Those were the first four initial episodes. There's a fifth now that came out. We'll watch that at some point as well. And I think it's on forestry. Discussion from the members?
What's the topic? Mr. Chairman, what is the topic of the fifth one?
I believe it's on forestry. We'll talk about firewood at that hearing. If there's no further discussion, we'll move on to Senate File 38, Senator Rest, Great Lakes Compact. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome.
Chairman.
Welcome. You have the honor of being our first bill.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm joined by Mr. Lochsmo from the DNR. There'll be some other testifiers about this bill. Senate File 38 is the opportunity for the Minnesota legislature to ratify the Great Lakes St. Lawrence River Basin's Water Resources Compact. And this is a bill that's resulted from a multi-year
process, particularly undertaken by the Council of Great Lakes Governors. All eight governors from the Great Lakes have signed on to this, which is an indication of their support for legislatures to pass this bill so that they can actually sign it into law, following which, since it is a compact, it needs to be also ratified by the Congress. Separately, an agreement exists that also includes the two provinces, Ontario and Quebec, that are also part of the Great Lakes Basin, but it is not, they're not part of the compact, of course, because they're not, they're obviously not in the in the United States. The only binational agreement or binational organization that exists is the Great Lakes Commission, which is does have members by from all of the Great Lakes states and from the two provinces, and I'm very pleased to be one of Minnesota's commissioners. In your, just by way of introduction to the materials that are in your folders, you will first of all find, before I get into describing the bill, a map that indicates the boundary lines of the three major watersheds in Minnesota, including the Lake Superior watershed, which is part of the Great Lakes Basin, the Red River or Hudson Bay watershed, and the Mississippi River watershed, and indicates those manufacturing areas that are inside each of the watersheds. Conveniently for us, we do not have ones that straddle the each of the watersheds. So you're either in one or the other. We'll talk about that perhaps a little bit later. Also, on the packet of slides from a PowerPoint that has been presented in any number of areas, I thought you might find some of the information about the Great Lakes themselves interesting to you, comparing what I consider to be the jewel of the Great Lakes, that is our own Lake Superior, with the attributes of the other Great Lakes that together are the source of so much of the fresh water available to all of the earth. In particular, then I would direct your attention to a couple of the second and third pages, which are just some question and answers that I think may also be of interest to you, that the Great Lakes themselves, for example, represent 18% of whole world's fresh water supply. And I won't go through all of those, but acting as good stewards, as your video was pointing out, of the Great Lakes is not only acting on behalf of our own state or even the Great Lakes Basin itself, but is acting on behalf of being good stewards for the fresh water that is such an important resource for our earth. Right now, the water resources, diversions, withdrawals, consumptive use for the Great Lakes, it operates under a federal act called WRDA, which is the Water Resources Development Act of 1986, which has been largely found to be ineffective in advancing the cause of stewardship with regard to withdrawals from the Great Lakes Basin. But it is what we had before, limited in scope because it did not include in-basin uses. It had very vague or hardly any definitions. There was questionable applicability to groundwater, and the premiers of the two Canadian provinces were not included in decision-making. Now they will be, not as part of the compact, but as part of the side agreement. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to also point out that I've included in the packets a resolution from the Minnesota Conservation Federation, which does endorse the compact. The compact, as I indicated earlier, is the result of several years of negotiations and input, public comment, reaction, and changes over time to an agreement that, although probably no one would consider perfect, has brought about a compromise that the business community, the state governments with their particular concerns or issues, and the environmental communities are willing to support at this time. Because it is a compact, it means that every state that signs on to it has to sign on to the exact same document. So it is, if any state tries to amend it, the compact itself is not held to be in effect. And, in fact, every other state would have to accept any state's amendments for it to go forward. Because Minnesota has such an extensive history in being good stewards of Lake Superior and our fresh water, the compact actually is not even as strict as what Minnesota's provisions with regard to water permitting is. We've had water permitting since 1937, and it is a system that has been accepted by the community at large, as opposed to some states which have no regulatory history with regard to water permits and diversions and withdrawals. So we believe that it is an opportunity once again for Minnesota to be a leader in showing other states that this compact can be passed as presented by our governor, and any kind of implementing legislation or interpretive legislation can come at some future date where we expect, which may be even as long as 5 or 6 years before other states, all the other states, finally act on the compact and it is presented to the Congress. The compact has 8 articles in it. You wouldn't be surprised to find that the first one is a group of definitions of the terms that are to be used in the compact, and I would draw your attention to a couple of them so that may respond to some questions that you might have or considerations that might come up. The compact will talk about straddling communities and straddling counties because water does not respect geophysical or geopolitical divisions or maps. And so we want to make sure that if there is a community or a county or a community within a county that straddles the Great Lakes Basin that has a need for water, that there is a way to go about permitting them to have a withdrawal. We talk about withdrawals. We talk about consumptive use and diversions. Consumptive use is on page 2 at line 216, and it means that that portion of the water that is withdrawn is and that is not otherwise lost or returned. To understand that in terms of evaporation or incorporation into a product, which is very different than a diversion. Also, there are distinctions that are to be made between intrabasin diversions and diversions that take water from inside the basin to outside the basin. The definition of straddling community is given on page 4, line 29, and it means, again, any community that's partly within the basin or partly within two Great Lakes watersheds. In section 1.3, which begins on page 5, we move to findings and purposes. And although the Minnesota Senate usually frowns on legislation that talks about the purpose of the bill and lets the language of the bill stand for itself, the compact does indeed have findings and purposes. And I would direct your attention to lines 525 through 530, which I believe is the most important finding of the compact, and that is that the parties, which means all the states, have a shared duty to protect, conserve, restore, improve, and manage the renewable but finite waters of the basin. In addition, then, starting at line 531, are the purposes described of the compact. There's also a section in that article and at the end of the article on the science of that is driving the agreements that we are reaching. Article 2 talks about a council that will be created under this compact that consists of the governors of the eight states who will come together to make decisions about water withdrawals. It used to be under WERDA that a single governor could veto any project that came up, and there was a lot of concern about that in the development of this compact. And the compromise was that there will be a simple, if a request from an applicant for a diversion or withdrawal rises to the level that it has to come to the council rather than be decided under the laws of the individual states, that a simple majority will control the policy rather than allowing the veto by a single state. And that was a particular concern of the Minnesota negotiators, and I'm pleased that we were able to assert that and that is what is part of the compact. And that comes up on page 17 at line 2 in terms of the voting. The governors themselves do not have to be present at the council meetings. They can appoint someone in their stead to represent the state of Minnesota. The rest of Article 2 speaks more to the organization. Article 3 talks about the general powers and duties of the council. Article 4 describes the water management and regulations. This is actually the programs. Talking about in the first section of that what the duties of the states will be. In the third paragraph under that section, what standards will be and what kind of permitting process will be undertaken. There are any number of points of reviewal within the compact. Reviewal after 5 years, reviewal after 2 years, and at one point even a reviewal after 10 years. At different points, looking back at what the results of the compact have been, and then asking for review either by the states themselves or by the council. When you get to section 4.9, there are, first of all, 4.8, there is a general prohibition against all new or increased diversions, except with certain exceptions, which then are detailed in section in 4.9. There are three categories that is dealing with public uses, straddling counties, and the from one basin to another. the rest of that article gets into the details of the management program. And if you have questions about that, I'll try to answer them. And certainly Mr. Lacusmo, who has been involved in these negotiations for a number of years on behalf of our state and the Department of Natural Resources, which is the lead agency in this area, I'm sure can answer them. I will point out there's an oddity, I believe, in the compact, beginning on section 22. Section 414 on page 22, beginning at line 24. There is a Supreme Court case that controls diversions for the state of Illinois from Lake Michigan, and that Supreme Court case controls the participation of Illinois in the compact, and so is mentioned in the compact, spelling out exactly what the Supreme Court has held there, the restrictions that Illinois is under with regard to diversions, but then further, even though they are granted major exceptions, that the state of Illinois is prohibited from using the compact to seek new or increased withdrawals or consumptive uses or diversions of basin water. Article 5 deals with consulting, the necessity, the opportunity of consulting with the tribes with regard to water diversions. Article 6 describes the way in which the public or the council is required to involve the public in participation in the process. In a sense, what is required is that they meet public meeting law, if you will. And what I would imagine, for example, in terms of an implementing statute in the future, is that at some point a legislator may indeed say that with regard to Article 6 of this compact, that public participation means that public participation in Minnesota means that they have to conform to the public meeting law. We're not undertaking that or not looking at those kinds of implementing language now. It would be far more appropriate to do so when anticipating the point at which the states have passed the compact, ratified it, and the federal government is prepared to endorse that ratification. Article 7 provides a way in which disputes will be settled under the compact, and Article 8 talks about the way in which state law relates to the compact, that you don't give up any right that you currently have under the compact to control your own state. And then Article 9 talks about, it's called effectuation, and it states the process under which then the law or the compact becomes an agreement that is enforced by by all eight states that by that time has endorsed it. So, Mr. Chairman, that is Senate File 38, and I would defer now to Mr. Lacusmo, and he can detail for you the role that Minnesota has played in the development of the compact, the considerations and issues and challenges that Minnesota brought to the compact process and how they were resolved. And I believe you have a handout from him that gives you an outline of that you can follow along as he describes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Kent Lockesmoen, the Director of the Division of Waters for DNR. And you have in your packets, I believe, a handout that is labeled in yellow, Great Lakes Compact. And let me set the context of how this compact fits with existing Minnesota law. As Senator Ress said, Minnesota is a leader in environmental protection of the Great Lakes, and we certainly have a program for appropriation permitting that far exceeds any of the other states. You'll see on the very front page is just an outline of the entire Great Lakes Basin with those respective watersheds highlighted. I suppose a bit of trivia for you, if you know the number of provinces that abut the Great Lakes proper would be one. It's only the province of Ontario. Quebec is just along the St. Lawrence Seaway. Then on the last page of this handout that you have shows the Lake Superior watershed proper, and it shows in pink some of the communities that straddle the community boundaries. So you have Hibbing, Mountain Iron, Babbitt, where the municipal boundaries are on both sides of the watershed boundary. And that's unlike, there's a number of other communities across the basin. Akron, Ohio, for example, is half in and half out. And there was a diversion request just recently approved for them. So this compact recognized those kinds of issues and dealt with them. Because it's not as simple as saying absolutely no diversions out of the Great Lakes Basin. There are some of these things like straddling communities that were discussed at length in this compact discussion group. I think Senator Ress talked about diversions and consumptive uses. Diversions, where you're taking water out of the Great Lakes Basin, is very strictly dealt with. As we talked about the voting threshold and those kinds of things, we got around having that unanimous vote by essentially prohibiting diversions out of the basin. So there isn't a vote on diversions out of the basin, but there are some exceptions then that we deal with as needed for the straddling communities, for example. Consumptive use are the communities, the industries, the other businesses within the basin that are actually using water. The threshold that we have for consumptive use is in this agreement is pretty high. Minnesota requires permits for any appropriation of water of more than 10,000 gallons a day or 1 million gallons a year. And if you look throughout this compact, it requires just a registration of use at 100,000 gallons a day. And where ours is actually a permit that is reviewed and has standards at one-tenth of that or 10,000 gallons a day. And the threshold where there's review by the adjacent states and provinces is a consumptive use of 5 million gallons a day. So that's, that is a large consumptive use. And that is a consumptive use, not just the total water use. So it's the amount of water actually consumed by that industry or project. And even then, what happens with the other states, they comment back, and on consumptive uses, the state where the project is occurring has the final say. They aren't being told what to do by the other states. And that was a concern for a number of the governors and a number of the states involved. Just a little bit of context, this 20-some years ago, 1985, there was a proposal for the coal slurry pipeline to use water from Lake Superior and go to Montana, and that prompted the Great Lakes Charter to be adopted. That was adopted in 1985. In the subsequent year, 1986, was the WRDA, Water Resources Development Act, a federal law that prohibited any diversion out without first getting the approval of all eight Great Lakes governors, and that essentially gives a governor veto authority. There was concern that without any real standards and there wasn't that there would be a legal challenge and that we might not be on the most solid ground. So developing this compact, providing some review standards, providing more process would help us to be able to defend any challenge against diversions out of the basin. So this went through, 6 or 7 years of discussion and getting through. There was lots of public review and comment. And actually through the first phase, I think we ended up changing pretty significantly what was in the compact. All eight governors have changed throughout the course of time. So there's been staff that have changed. There have been different people involved in this process throughout. I'm probably one of the few. I don't know. I'm not sure how many of the staff throughout this have remained the same. I have. I'm not sure if that's good or bad. On December 13, 2005, the governor signed a commitment that we would seek adoption of this compact. And that's the process that all of the states are going through now. Minnesota has the opportunity to be first. It hasn't passed any other states. It got close in Ohio last year. It passed their House. It got held up in the Senate in the final weeks of their session, so that didn't happen. You know, we were concerned throughout that we look at how this would impact Minnesota industry. The mining industry is along the Laurentian Divide, the watershed boundary between Lake of the Woods and Lake Superior. So one of the ways that that's happened is that existing uses are grandfathered in. So if there happens to be a business, a mining company that's operating today that bisects or is on both sides of that watershed divide, that's grandfathered in, and things will be grandfathered in as of the date the compact becomes effective. So we've dealt with that. There are provisions to deal with straddling communities. I said for Minnesota's program is pretty far above, I think, these other the other states. We've dealt with priority water users. We have a statutory priority system. Our thresholds have been around for quite some time, and it's, like I said, 10,000 gallons a day is where permits are first required. There are some other statutory language dealing with consumptive uses of more than 2 million gallons a day. Some of those things, once this compact becomes effective, we could take care of at that time. We could delete some language. We wouldn't want to do that until the compact's actually effective and we have language that takes its place. The 5 million gallons a day threshold, just so you know, that would be equivalent to the domestic use for about 60,000 people. I mean, that's like the city of St. Cloud's water use. So that's what 5 million gallons a day gets you. We dealt with all of the Minnesota concerns as we work through this process. There is a conservation provision in here where the council and staff are working with their with all the partners to develop a conservation plan for the entire basin. There is a small oversight structure that will deal with issues as they come up and with potential diversions. We've met locally with environmental groups and the Minnesota Chamber and other industry groups. To the best of my knowledge, there's no opposition to this. They're used to our regulatory framework, and this doesn't add anything new for regulatory framework for industries or uses within Minnesota. And I think with that, I could probably just take questions, Mr. Chairman, if you would.
Does the compact do anything other than regulate water diversion?
Mr. Chairman, no, this is just over the water use. Water diversions, consumptive uses, and there would be a conservation standard. The Minnesota already has conservation. This isn't doing anything else in Minnesota that isn't currently already being done. In other states who don't have a permit program, they have to adopt some regulatory type of program to meet the requirements within the compact. In Minnesota, we already have all of those bases covered.
And is Minnesota allowed to be stricter than this compact after it is ratified?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Does it need approval of the compact states to be stricter before it does that?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Senator Olson.
Is this the first perfect bill to ever come before us that absolutely has no need of amendment?
I apologize, Senator Olson. We may need you to repeat the question. We didn't hear it.
I'm sorry.
I just wanted to know if this is the first perfect bill that's come before the legislature that absolutely has no need of amendment.
And probably the last.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, certainly there are, this bill or the compact represents compromise, and there are those who might wish that a provision had been addressed that wasn't, or that it wasn't done exactly the way they wanted. But I do think it's one of those instances where, as our governor actually is fond of saying, that the perfect shouldn't stand in the way of the good. And that's what we have in this compact.
And Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, Senator S., is it generally expected that the members that will be presenting to the other states will be as convincing as you are in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, as Mr. Lacismo said, this compact does not represent a stretch for Minnesota in terms of its regulatory history, which goes back some 70 years here.
Years.
And other states are just beginning to look at a permitting process and how they're going about it. When we talk about the water permitting here, the 10,000 gallons, for example, our permitting system is each well is individually permitted. There's some concern in, for example, I believe in the state of Michigan, where wells are grouped together to reach that, to reach whatever level it is that they're going to be at in order to trigger a special application or whatever. And so there is more concern, for example, among farmers in the state of Michigan over the compact than there is here in Minnesota. So it is, we want to show, however, the rest of the Great Lakes states that it is possible to pass this compact without significant attempts at amending by any interest group or stakeholder, and that we can wait for implementing or interpretive legislation in the future. And so Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, it perhaps is easier for Minnesota to do this, but it's also an opportunity for us to be the leader in doing it and showing the other states that it can be done. And perhaps what they ought to be doing is looking at our permitting legislation, our conservation initiatives, as also showing them the way to be responsible for 18% of the world's fresh water.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, there is an advantage of passing this first and without amendment, because I think it would put the other states they may be more apt to then just pass it without trying to change it. Because if somebody changed it first, they might think they could convince all the other seven of us states to change it because they had a great idea. We think the negotiated settlement is where we want to be.
Senator Parasol.
Mr. Chairman, my question is to both the people at the table, Senator Rest and Mr. Lacmore. And the last line in the near last paragraph on page 4 of this page I'm looking at, failure to pass a compact on by outside human intervention. Will we be descended upon by the UN, for instance, or who? There are some people who should not live in the state. I believe the UN is one.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Parasol, would you give me the reference again to your comment?
What document?
It's the document on the last page.
Testimony from David Master.
Almost at the bottom. Mm.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Parasol, I believe what you're speaking to is a testimony of David Nafsker, who will follow us.
I'm sorry.
Senator Fredrickson.
I'll let you ask that question of that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, to the point of amending this, As I was reading through this, I found the several places where it's not phrased as we would normally phrase it in the Minnesota legislature, and there are words used that we typically do not use in the manner they're used here. Would it break the agreement if we made grammatical changes or word use changes that are non-substantive?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Fredrickson, I noticed some of those as well, and there was at least some brief discussion about correcting punctuation and grammar, and we decided not to go that route. And one of the reasons for it is at some point someone might make a change that, although on the surface might look like a punctuation or a grammatical change or a better turn of phrase, that in other states would have, because of their legislative history or their statutes, might have more of an impact. So if there is, I don't think there are any misspellings, but the a grammatical use of particular phrases that are more than just the definition of the terms and or punctuation are left as is, as promoted by the Great Lakes Council of Governors.
Why don't we move on to the next witness? Why don't we bring Mr. Nafker in?
It's not perfect, in other words. It's not perfect.
Well, welcome to the committee. We have your written testimony here as well. And we've got another bill to get to before 2:45, but we welcome your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'll make my comments very brief. As you mentioned, I did include a written submission that provides an overview of the Council of Great Lakes Governors and the process that was used to develop the compact that is now before you. Just very briefly, I'd like to recognize the leadership of the governors, including Governor Pawlenty, and also the role of Kent Lacusmo and Jim Japs from the Minnesota DNR in the development of the compact. Very briefly, there is significant momentum building behind enactment of the compact in the Great Lakes states. Legislation was just introduced last week in the Indiana Senate, and as Mr. Lacusmo referenced earlier, the compact did pass one chamber in New York and also in Ohio last year. Legislation was also introduced in Illinois and Michigan, and Wisconsin has convened a special legislative committee that has been working on the compact and state-specific implementing measures, and it's expected that a recommendation will be coming out of committee very soon. Compact legislation is also anticipated soon in Pennsylvania. This compact is really an opportunity for Minnesota to continue its legacy of leadership on the Great Lakes. As the previous witnesses referenced, Minnesota has done a commendable job of protecting the Great Lakes, implementing the Great Lakes Charter that was signed in 1985, and action by this committee and by this state will be very significant in terms of stimulating action by the other states and ultimately Congress. To the question that was raised previously, there are significant vulnerabilities in terms of the current legal framework, as was alluded to by Senator Rest. And this is an opportunity for the states to retain authority over the Great Lakes and decisions about them in this region. If we as a region fail to take this opportunity, it's very likely that the courts and Congress will make a decision for us about how things ought to be done. And because of the uncertainty and the fact that many of those decision makers are outside of this region, that is something that has been viewed as quite a risk and something that we would be wise to avoid. So with that, I'll close my remarks. I am joined here today by my colleague Peter Johnson, who's a program director with the Council of Great Lakes Governors. Both of us were involved in the development process over the course of the last several years, and we're happy to work with you today and also into the future if there are issues you would like to talk with us about. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for the witness? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, just trying to understand. I think I understand, but if you could just refresh me quickly. At what point is the compact enacted and law? Is after all the states ratify it? And it's one that we see.
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dribble, that's correct.
And Mr. Chair, does the Canadian federal government also have to act?
Congress needs to act.
Mr. Chair, Senator, as was described earlier, this is an agreement among the eight Great Lakes states. So to become effective, it requires the state legislative action and congressional action. There is a separate agreement that includes Ontario and Quebec. The federal governments are not party to that agreement.
Thank you. And just
Senator Dibble?
One comment. Is it fair to say that one of the basic principles that lies under this agreement is that take a lot of water out of the Great Lakes Basin, send it somewhere far away, maybe the other southwest. That water's simply not going to come back. Recharging the Great Lakes takes many years, and that water simply is not going to return to the Great Lakes. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, yes.
Okay.
There are two other witnesses, if they could speak briefly.
Ms. Wolf, Mr. Botson.
Or one. Or both.
Go ahead, Ms. Wolf.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'll be very brief. I'm here today on the I'm Allison Wolf. I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and also the 80-plus members of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. When this issue came before the MEP group as a possible priority issue for the session, they had planned to have only three issues for the session, but this received such a positive reaction that they decided to have 3.5 issues. So this is the 3.5 priority issue for MEP. We are just here to add our voice to say that moving forward to be the first state to ratify the Great Lakes Compact would be a very exciting step for Minnesota to take, and we encourage you to move the bill today in order to make that happen. And we particularly endorse the feature that the chairman highlighted earlier, that this allows the state to continue to be more protective. It does not restrict that in any way, and we're certainly echoing your concern about that. So we endorse ratification, and I'll let you get on to the next witness.
Thank you, Mr. Botsick.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Gary Botsick, I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Conservation Federation. I've got one more handout for you if I can get a page. We obviously support this. You saw our resolution. Thank you very much, Senator S., for putting that in the packet. We work directly with the National Wildlife Federation, and this references a lot of work that they've done. They work out of our Ann Arbor office in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we wholeheartedly support the legislation in front of you, including some of the exotic legislation, which we'll be dealing with at some later hearings. If I could, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to yield the rest of my time to Mark Peterson, is here from Audubon, one of my other clients, and would like to also put their name on record in support of this legislation in 15 seconds flat. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Botsick.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Peterson. I'm executive director of Audubon, Minnesota, the state office of the National Audubon Society. We have about over 10,000 members and 12 chapters in Minnesota, and our work is to work with others to conserve and restore natural ecosystems, focusing on birds and other wildlife and their habitats. And I'm here today to endorse ratification of the Great Lakes Compact. Audubon, Minnesota has identified two important bird areas located on Lake Superior with more anticipated. The North Shore Peregrine Falcon Eyries is made up of 9 discrete locations along Lake Superior, representing 70% of the natural peregrine falcon nest sites recorded in Minnesota. The second important bird area is Hawk Ridge in Duluth each fall, which hosts more than 100,000 raptors migrating along Superior's coast and is a major bird watching event in Minnesota. In addition, there are several water bird colonies along Lake Superior, such as the Knife River. Clean water that is within historic water levels are critical to these species and these important bird areas. These important bird areas are sites that provide essential habitat for one or more species of birds. And you can imagine if we draw down the water of Lake Superior, what they would do not only to these critical habitats, but also to the estuaries, the wetlands, and other habitats along Lake Superior. Lake Superior is the, by surface area, the world's largest freshwater lake, containing 10% of our planet's surface water. I mean, 1/10 of all water on the planet is in Lake Superior. This is a resource that is to be much treasured and protected, and I would encourage you to move as rapidly as possible so we could be the first state to ratify the Great Lakes Compact. Thank you very much.
Is there any testimony in opposition to Senate File 38? This is going to have to go to the Committee on State and Local Government afterwards.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File Number 38 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
Further discussion? Senator Dibble.
I'll just thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just remind our members that we did vote on a compact last year that Senator Scheid carried out in Commerce. And I believe the streamlined sales tax
Well, I was on the Judiciary Committee. I think this is more perfect than the other one. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson.
Before we leave the topic, there's this question and answer thing, and two of them have got two answers blocked. Can you clarify what that means? The depth of Lake Superior and how many years of water is retained in Lake Michigan, Lake Erie. I don't know if one belongs to one and one belongs to the other, but.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, for the one question, how deep is Lake Superior? The 483 feet is the average depth. 1,332 is the maximum depth. And on number five, they're asking the question about Lake Michigan and Lake Erie. So it's 2.6 years water is retained in Lake Erie and 99 years in Lake Michigan.
Oh, that's
the other way around.
Yeah, so they're kind of.
Thank you.
On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevailed.
Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Sieben, if you feel that your bill will be rushed, we can take it at the next meeting, or if you are ready to do it now and feel you've got enough time, we're happy to do it now. Okay. Senate File 65. We have a delete all.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I do have a delete all amendment, which I hope that
it's being passed out. Go ahead and explain your. You can start explaining the delete all.
Certainly.
While it's being passed out.
Mr. Chairman and members, this Senate file deals with the threat of the aquatic invasive species. Essentially, what this bill does is call on Congress to act with regard to the treatment of ballast water in the Great Lakes region, recognizing the detrimental effects both economically and environmentally of aquatic invasive species. This bill is a step, one step towards trying to address the issue of ballast water and the transmission of aquatic invasive species. In talking with Senator Solon and also Senator Rest, they have separate bills that call on the state of Minnesota to treat ballast water. This bill is more taking the position of asking the state of Minnesota to say we want the federal government to be involved in the resolution of this issue. And members, the delete all amendment came about as a result. Michigan passed this legislation a couple of years ago, and Representative Hansen introduced this bill in the House and wanted to update the language to make it more accurate for the time and also to highlight the threat of the fish-killing VHS virus, which members have a handout about that. Stand for questions, and Gary Botsek again would like to speak in favor of the bill as well.
Why don't we act on the delete all? This is an author's amendment. First opportunity to hear the bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? I apologize. I didn't hear a motion, so
I'm sorry.
We'll call that the Sieben motion.
Thank
on the
you,
A2
Mr.
amendment.
Sherrod.
Was there anyone opposed? Okay, motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Senator Sieben, do you want to introduce your witness?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, Gary Botzik, again from the Minnesota Conservation Federation.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, back for round two. I think your introductory movie tells the story. Since the St. Lawrence Seaway opened in 1959, 79 indigenous or non-indigenous species have been introduced to this system, Seaway all the way up through Lake Superior. We know you've got in your packet an article in the Star Tribune relating to the new mussel that's they're using letters you find in Scramble now that you want it to identify this new mussel. And interestingly enough, Mr. Chairman, zebra mussel has been found in a number of locations in lakes in Minnesota, and many people believe they're coming right from Lake Superior as we move boats from Lake Superior into our regular lake system. There's also the influence of the St. Croix River from the south as well. But this is a big problem, and we need to push Congress a little bit harder on this to move forward. There's been reference to Senator Rest, and Representative Hansen have also got another bill on ballast water where the state of Minnesota can provide some additional leadership. But all this bill does, Mr. Chairman, is memorialize Congress, and I think we need to move them in that direction. They need something to do in the second 100 hours. So this will give them more food for thought.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is a fine resolution, and I support it. I'm a co-signer of it. But to my earlier remarks, reflecting on what Senator Caruso said, we don't want folks coming in here telling us how and what to do. But we are. We're accepting word from on high that we just have to accept all these ships coming in, and there's nothing we can do or say about it. All these ships are coming in, and they're dumping their ballast water in our harbors and in the Great Lakes. And just a few months before this article appeared, remember the New Zealand mud snail is now established in Cape Cod. And every few months, it's something new, and we know the impact on the ecosystem. So this is fine in prodding federal government to act, but they've been sitting around the table yapping at each other and have done nothing, exactly nothing to date on this. And I think time is on this one.
And we all know how you feel about New Zealand, Senator Dibble.
Well, and Mr. Chair, ironically, New Zealand is extremely stringent, as is Australia, on allowing anything to, because they've got a very fragile ecosystem, and they wouldn't for a half a second tolerate the kind of stuff that we tolerate. Just let it come in and out. Unfettered.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Botzik, I was looking at the quagga mussel just to which you referred. And I want to know, we Scrabble players would be a lot more excited about this if they were spelled without the U.
I would agree, Mr. Chairman. Senator.
Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 65 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Rules. I'm informed that all resolutions need to go to Rules. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, what in your view is the greatest contributor to this inertia at the federal level on something that's as significant to this? Who's blocking?
Senator Dibble?
Money from big shipping companies? Or?
Mr. Chair, yes, Senator Olson. As a matter of fact, when I introduced my bill, immediately on my doorstep, was the industry saying, oh, we're just going to kill that. And they did. It's the age old, well, we can't afford it. It's expensive and it's hard. People are hard about it. However, it's a direct threat, as Mr. Botzik will tell you, it's a great threat to many other very important industries in the state, such as tourism.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, was yours just a resolution? Or did you have a more stringent bill that you'd introduced?
Senator Dibble?
My bill requires that ballast water be sterilized before it's dumped by whatever means.
Thank you.
And it's my understanding it could be done for as little as $200 a ship. Is that right, Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, nothing or a few hundred dollars a ship to stabilize that water.
And they pay tens of thousands of dollars in fees, do they not?
Yeah.
Already?
Yeah.
Okay. On the Sieben motion on Senate File 65 as amended, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Thank you, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Anything else from the committee? So on Wednesday, we'll hear dedicated funding. Meeting's adjourned.
Go to my next committee over at the History Center.
Okay.
So can I just briefly tell you about this?
Yeah.